right here, Baptiste.
Are you hurt?
Kane sat up and slipped the Sin Eater back into its forearm holster.
Just a few bruises. Like Grant said, mags are a hard-headed bunch. Besides, I took most of the hit against my shoulders.
You only just got over being smacked in the head by a rock a while ago.
Brigid looked at the tossed corpse of the Naga rebel. Unlike the group that had attempted to kidnap the Queen, he wasn't wearing Nephilim armor, and had only a standard handgun stuffed into his waist sash.
Enlil must have been stingy with his toys.
Since when has the old bastard ever been any kind of generous?
When he's attempting to overthrow a hidden society?
Kane! Brigid! You all right in there?
Oh, what did the Queen call his voice?
Stentorian.
Is that Latin for busting my eardrum?
Close enough.
Well, excuse the hell out of me for worrying about you two. Any prisoners on that silver egg?
No. What about the other insurgents on the ground?
Whoever you didn't take care of tried to run and were burned down by some pissed off snake soldiers. Not that I blame them. The good guys lost some more people.
We're not here 2 hours, and already we've got a civil war with the death toll in the double digits.
Kane indicated that Brigid turn off her contact.
It's not our fault.
I never said that it was. But what proof do we have that Durga is setting this whole thing up?
Even if we'd taken one of the insurgents alive as a witness, it probably wouldn't do much good. Durga seems smart enough to have supplied these idiots through a cutout.
So back to square one, except for a few extra bruises and some ringing in our ears.
Durga will make a mistake, and when he does...
Brigid touched the interface for the command panel and the hatch opened, deploying a ramp to the ground. Durga and the others were outside, looking at the pair. Kane held Brigid's hand, steadying her as they walked down the ramp.
Sorry about the helicopter.
Grant lost contact with you. We were worried more about you than a hunk of machinery.
Feedback in our contacts. We had to break contact before the wine melted our ears off.
I think you'd look better without ears, Brigid.
Thank you, but I prefer being a mammal.
Just keep in mind that as king, I am allowed to have a queen and a consort.
Brigid looked at Kane, who was doing a less than remarkable job of concealing the jealousy on his face.
Thanks for the offer.
She smiled diplomatically and walked away from the Naga prince.
She's not interested?
Nothing personal. She's got a prior commitment.
Ah.
If you'll excuse me.
Kane walked off to join Brigid. Any compunction that Kane still had about punching the suspected conspirator into a messy pulp vaporized the moment he turned his attention toward Brigid. Suddenly the back of Kane's neck prickled. His danger sense warned him that he'd made a tactical error. He looked back at Durga, who stood with smug satisfaction on his face, surrounded by a dozen fellow Naga who would be able to corroborate Kane's barely contained jealous reaction to Durga's flirtations with Brigid. Cold dread speared into Kane's heart as he realized that as surely as the Cerberus rebels had manipulated Durga before, the prince had just returned the favor. Kane was unsure of Durga's purpose in getting on his nerves, but most likely Durga had a frame in mind, and Kane had stepped right into the provocation. He remembered when he was a magistrate patrolling Cobaltville, the number one reason for murder in the Ville was jealousy. Kane grimaced as he watched Durga.
Oh, damn. I just gave you all the motive for an assassination you could ask for. And after that attack of the magistrates 3 decades ago, you probably have a Sin Eater to make it a perfect frame.
Durga entered his mother's bedroom.
Son, what brings you here?
I came to inform you of the details of the most recent incident.
Yes, my guards gave me the details. They call themselves the Fist of Enlil, and they attempted to hijack the skimmer. I wish I could be more presentable to the heroes of Cerberus.
Oh, you look splendid, Mother. But you really should give yourself more time to recover from your previous ordeal.
Who are you? And what have you done with my son?
I'm just worried about you.
Usually you're impatient with me.
Usually I am. But only because you treat me like a bitter, vengeful brat. But this time, you're actually allowing me to do what I do best.
My city has come under attack, and like it or not, you are the warrior prince of the Naga. When it comes to wreaking vengeance, you are the finest.
You don't appear very proud of that.
It's hardly a respectable vocation. Murdering for a cause.
That cause is the survival of our species.
The forces against us have always failed at driving us to extinction.
Not for lack of trying. And if it hadn't been for my efforts at recruitment, we would never
have... You have recruited new blood to our race. But at the same time, you treat them as second-hand citizens. Why, Durga? Why would you work to alienate the very people you've brought into our fold?
To make them work hard to prove me wrong and prove their worth.
That's a horrible way to inspire your people.
And yet, the Naga now have the finest craftsmen, the bravest warriors, and the most patriotic of citizens. I may speak ill of them, but when they excel, I am also there to reward them.
Why can't you just be kind to your subjects and to the woman who would be your queen?
Hana is a strong woman. The forge I am putting her through will only increase that strength.
I thought I had brought you up better.
You? Garuda did that job. He taught me. He made me into a warrior. He made me into the son of a god. And I've lived the past 3 decades trying to maintain that deification.
You are insane.
I'm still the one you're counting on.
Durga, please.
Devon Lan, crouched in the shadows, watching the Naga warriors lower their anti-aircraft missiles, noting that they seemed to have been positioned to prevent the escape of some kind of flying machine. Whatever crisis there had been, it was over. Lan returned his silenced Coleco machine pistol to its slung position over his shoulder. At first, he couldn't believe the serpentine appearance of the Naga. Men with all the armored scales, folding fangs, and neck hoods of a cobra. The visage of the snake men was imposing, even to a millennial consortium paramilitary commander. The cobra was legendary around the globe for being a deadly serpent. Its attributes, combined with that of a human being, added up to a walking nightmare that turned his bowels to ice. Throw in the well-maintained small arms and heavy weapons that the creatures possessed, and Lan realized that the hundreds of Southeast Asian and Indian pirates and bandits he'd recruited for this combat expedition were a necessary burden. Nguyen, one of the highest-ranking recruits, knelt next to him, lowering his binoculars. The Vietnamese pirate's beard managed to conceal most of the scar tissue that covered his cheeks and jaw. Compared to Lan, a Eurasian man raised in the wilds of North America, Nguyen was a wiry, hardened thug.
Those hangar doors are huge.
According to Fargo's final report, they had 3 transport and utility helicopters in pursuit of him.
3 aircraft are a lot to search for one man.
Fargo wasn't the only fleeing prey. The expedition we'd sent before was large, around 60 men. Fargo was the only one smart enough to play dead, though.
So why isn't he with us?
The board of directors did not feel he would be best used in this manner. He has to earn his return to the consortium's good graces the hard way.
By being our target marker. Hell of a way to redeem yourself.
That's not my concern. Come on, let's get back to the rest of the force.
I'll take the point.
The pirate mercenary led Lan back along the path they had taken to the front gates of the hangar, a route that had been handed down from the consortium's contact. Apparently, an Anunnaki overlord was supplying the millennialists with all the information they needed to blindside the Naga. The advance intelligence, including patrol routes and angles of approach. Lan's skepticism told him that this information was too good to be true, but the directors informed Lan that it was his place to confirm the usefulness of the supplied data, then to make use of that knowledge to increase the lethal power of their assault on the snake people. Anyone or anything capable of putting up a fight was to be exterminated. Toward that goal, the Millennial Expeditionary Force had been supplied with crates of grenade launchers and SIG-AMT assault rifles, as well as their signature Coleco sidearms. Some of the raiding army brought their own heavier artillery, literally. Nguyen's crew had a pair of man-portable mortar units, munitions launchers, reverse-engineered from Japanese knee mortars. With the ability to hammer the hangar with high-explosive rounds, Lan felt confident that he'd be able to neutralize the air force of the Naga. Without the ability to maintain air superiority, the Cobra folk would lose their greatest advantage over the grounded consortium assault. Lan was glad to get back to his lines. The supreme commander of the assault force, a former magistrate named Christian, had spread the small army across several small pockets under the forest canopy. Christian stood well over 6 feet tall, a towering pillar of strength, who managed to keep the assembled thugs in line with just the force of his will. His reddish hair conformed to his blunt skull.
Report.
All information has been confirmed correct. We located three patrols but did not engage. There was also crisis-level activity at the hangar doors.
What kind?
Naga had surrounded their own hangar doors and had rocket launchers ready to engage an escaping aircraft.
Bargo said he was going to infiltrate the Naga's ranks once more with the help of the Cerberus group. However, it doesn't follow that Kane and his people would try to steal a helicopter to escape, especially after having been in there only a few hours.
You have confirmation of their presence?
Bader has been monitoring all communications in the area. Lakesh made arrangements for a pickup. We sent another scout party to that location.
Did we see what they had?
They left behind a couple of heavy weapons. A rocket launcher, heavy anti-tank rifle, and a medium machine gun, as well as a communications relay.
Have we been able to listen in?
No. They have the signals encrypted. It's just a relay, transmitting to a satellite and presumably back to their headquarters. However, during the period of time when you described the Naga responding to a crisis, there were no signals being beamed toward Cerberus.
They'd have been looking for assistance if they were attempting a breakout. So there's something else going on here.
The Naga have broadcast that a terrorist group calling themselves the Fist of Enlil attempted to steal a captured skimmer from the hangar. It could be disinformation, but that's not likely.
Enlil? Did the directors state who our Anunnaki benefactor was, Christian?
Negative. It's possible that even they don't know. But when you get handed a gift, you make use of it.
And there's nothing to indicate that the terrorists are actually linked to Enlil, right?
Apparently they know enough to fly a skimmer. Right now, the entire city is on lockdown, with a curfew to keep conspirators from doing their work in the shadows. With the Naga military and police distracted with internal troubles, we'll have the perfect opportunity to hit them unaware.
When the Naga soldiers were returning to base, we saw a perfect entrance to make our initial strike.
They won't know what hit them.
Domi moved swiftly through the utility tunnels in the Naga metropolis. On the other end of their contact link, Lakesh guided her movements. The Cerberus adventurers had only two known quantities on their side, Princess Hanna and her bodyguard Manticore, that would not betray their skulking to Durga. They too suspected that Durga was involved in some plot to turn the Cobra people into a dangerous threat. Domi paused as she noticed a hatch down the tunnel was open. A snake man entered the pipe and turned away from her, heading toward a new location. Domi crawled through the darkness, her multi-optic visor allowing her to stay on the snake man's trail.
Domi, you've grown silent.
Someone else just crawled in here with me.
A repairman?
No. No light, no toolbox. I'm following him.
Beloved, that's too risky. What if he notices you?
Always wanted a pair of Naga hide boots.
Domi.
Talk to you later.
Durga moved swiftly to the hatch in his den. It was Hedin, a former member of Durga's personal guard, now promoted to the rank of colonel in the Naga Defense Force. Hedin crawled out of the access hatch, pushing a pair of active night vision goggles off his sloped, scaled forehead.
Did anyone follow you?
No. I'm sorry that the Fist's effort to acquire the skimmer failed, but you gave Kane and his allies all the access they required to foil the plot.
The skimmer is irrelevant to our plans for now. We have the means to access the knowledge of Enki, so that plundering the other Anunnaki secrets is no longer necessary.
What? But won't Enlil be frustrated that we're deviating from the plan?
No. Enlil won't be a factor in this. You see, the carvings we so lovingly copied around the city are more than just historical reminders. They may be the key to understanding Enki's programming for the Cobra Bats.
How did you find this out?
It was the archivist Baptiste. She's had experience with studying the language of the old gods and feels that the pictograms are part of a control interface.
But they are just symbols carved in rock.
Somewhere in the mechanism of the Cobra Bats is a true control panel. We can then direct the nanomachinery inside of the baths to do whatever we want them to.
Immortality is a fine price. But right now, we have another, more pressing concern, Durga.
The consortium is in place?
A patrol squad caught movement, but we were unable to determine if it was an intruder or local fauna. I had one of the trusted take a closer look at the trail, and he reported that it was indeed two humans who had come within yards of the hangar entrance. They returned back down the same trail, escaping notice this time, and returned to where we suspect the humans have set up their staging grounds.
Durga retrieved a map.
Give me the exact locations.
Hedin marked off the position of the trail and the spot to which their trusted scout had trailed the intruders.
It was a company-sized unit, approximately 40 to 60 men. No vehicles, and the base is well camouflaged.
Only one company? I was hoping that the consortium would have learned from their prior mistakes when I informed them of our position and military strength.
It's not necessarily just that one unit. On the way back to his normal patrol route, the scout spotted evidence of another unit. It was a faint glimpse, and if he would not have attracted unwanted attention by his absence, he would have investigated it further.
Durga looked at the suspected second unit's position.
They're sticking to the thickest parts of the forest. Very hard to see from the air, and the ground is relatively uneven, allowing them to keep out of sight of our patrols.
Durga made seven more circles in similar areas to the two known consortium positions and smiled.
9 times 50.
Close to 500 soldiers, if all the units are of the same size. We could be looking at a devastating attack.
That's what we want. The Matron is under the delusion that because we have made friends with the humans from Cerberus, all of humankind can be considered potential allies. I've worked too hard fanning the fear of the hairless apes to allow a trio of heroes to flush that all away. It's time to start consolidating the trusted soldiers, so they won't become cannon fodder.
I've already begun that, Durga. As it is, we will lose a lot of good fighters.
We have a new advantage, thanks to Kane. We have the skimmer and its weaponry.
You realize that this is a betrayal of our oath to defend the Naga and keep them from harm.
What greater harm can there be than having our fangs plucked? We are on the path to becoming weak worms. We need to inform the citizenry that we have to use our venom against the hated animals.
And having the humans make the first strike is the justification to launch a brand new crusade. And what about the Cerberus people?
They are the enemies of the Millennial Consortium. They would not mind going after a group of murderers with dreams of tyranny. They've clashed many times before. Have they been monitoring our communications?
The trusted ones have been broadcasting misinformation that will get them into position to make the moves we want them to.
I'll get in touch with my men in the Fist. We'll need a good distraction tonight, and I want the security forces on full alert. This way, the consortium will make their move.
This will be worth it? All of this?
Durga looked at his desk. A glance to one side showed that the hatch was cracked ajar. His eyes narrowed, and he put his finger to his lips. Hedin's face showed a flash of panic, his hand dropping to the handgun on his hip, but Durga shook his head. A gunshot in Durga's office would attract too much attention, especially with the presence of a military officer who was supposed to be acting independently of royal influence. Hedin grimaced, realizing that their secrecy had just made them even more vulnerable to a spy's attention. Durga frowned, accusation that Hedin's insistence on not being followed was wrong. Hedin condemned himself, guilt flooding his being. He moved his hand to the dagger in his belt, and Durga nodded. In the tunnel, Domi heard Durga go silent and drew her cheek back from the hatch. The open door had been noticed, and she knew it was time to go. Her slender, muscular limbs drew her along immediately, scurrying through the tunnels like an albino spider. She twisted down a side tunnel, yanking her feet out of sight as a lamp blazed along the floor. She saw it, her multi-optic picking up the illumination from Hedin's active night vision. Domi kept herself tucked in tightly, not moving. She checked the depression she'd squirmed into, and while pipes extended through this passage, there was no room to squeeze along them. There was another passage on the other side. If Hedin were to crawl back this way, there was a chance that he'd notice her.
Domi? Domi, answer me. Domi, just speak.
The glow of Hedin's night vision illuminator disappeared. Domi twisted out into the repair tunnel.
I'm fine, but I didn't want anyone to hear me talking to you.
I know.
They didn't want anyone to know what they were talking about. Otherwise, they wouldn't be skulking about like thieves.
Like you?
Domi reached the next intersection.
You already knew I was a shantytown rat when I first came to Cerberus. These snakes are supposed to have a hint of nobility, right? So why is Durga talking about how he gave the consortium a chance to strike at the Naga?
His plan is to incite his people into a war.
So what can we do? We let the consortium attack, innocent people will die.
No, we can't allow it. But Durga was too clever to mention exactly where the troops are, in case anyone was indeed listening.
Then call Bri. The Naga know that we're going to watch them back. So we have satellites in the skies looking down on this place.
Right. Just come back. I'm getting worried that someone else will find you. And then there's this distraction that Durga wants to arrange.
I'm on my way. Just let Kane know, okay?
Lakesh paced in the Cerberus Exile suite, looking at Kane. Disappointment colored the scientist's face as he digested what Kane had just told him.
You let Durga get under your skin enough to give him an excuse to blame you for taking a shot at him?
We're looking at someone who's managed to get the consortium past his own country's defenses and convince them that he was an Anunnaki himself. Plus, I didn't think it would matter.
Well, everyone makes mistakes.
We can save the lectures for after we deal with the consortium.
Correct, friend Kane. Besides, I've had my missteps in the past as well.
Kane shoved his guilt aside and fought a headache that was just pounding behind his ears.
So, does Bri have the coordinates of the consortium forces?
Yes, ape.
Lakesh's grin spread, needle-sharp teeth showing behind his lips. Kane blinked in disbelief, then realized that his pain was the signal that his perceptions were being altered. Kane reached out and grabbed Lakesh's cheek. Digging his fingers into the flesh, he felt it go soft, peeling away from reptilian skin. Under tatters of rubbery flesh, Enlil grinned at Kane.
It's really too bad that the actions taken in one of these telepathic conferences don't occur in the real world. It would have been amusing when you awakened to see Lakesh's face bleeding all over the floor.
So, when did you get into telepathic communication?
I'd found a little trinket in one of my older caves. It allows for instantaneous conferencing that could reach around the globe if necessary. Unfortunately, since my brothers and I are not on close terms after Lilitu's escapade, its utility is limited.
If that were the case, Snake Face, how come I keep hearing the hum of it when you talk to Durga?
Balaam keeps speaking highly of your intellect. He spent a long time touching that mind of yours. This is an interesting little realm.
So what are you in here for?
Seeing what you've learned so far.
Trying to probe my mind. But you just said your trinket was just for communication.
That's true. But you never know. You might want to spoil things for Durga, especially if he seems to be acting against me. He's not your friend.
What gives you the delusion that I want to suddenly be your buddy? If either of you stabs the other in the back, it's all cake for me.
Enlil walked around the memory image of Bridget. His talons reached out to caress her, but Kane snatched Enlil's wrist. Kane dispersed his memory of Bridget, fading her into non-existence.
See? Even when you're not saying a word, you betray your deepest concerns and wishes. Just the thought of me touching your beloved little archivist spurs you to physical violence. This kind of information is worth its weight in gold.
Thoughts don't weigh a thing.
A figure of speech.
As if you didn't know in the first place. As if it's some big secret that Baptiste and I have feelings for each other.
Your discomfort with those feelings makes you vulnerable to manipulation. How many times have you undertaken perilous odds to ensure her safety? So, what were you talking about? The consortium in the area?
You tell me, Mr. Telepathy.
Well, I do remember you asking if Bri had their coordinates, which means...
Which means Bri's using our satellites to look for the consortium in the Naga's backyard. You know, the others are going to wonder why I'm sitting there drooling.
Good. Maybe your allies should consider you mentally unstable. After all, how sane can you really be if you're attempting to usurp the very being who created your race?
Sane enough. You haven't proved you're responsible enough to run your own species. So, I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to cease and desist and retire to the nearest available parallel dimension.
Oh, are you a god?
Remember our first dust-up on Tiamat? I was the one who walked away from that fight. Your ass ended up at the bottom of a pyramid. I don't know if that makes me a god, but if I can kick your ass, I'm pretty sure that I can tell you to get the fuck out of my universe.
Why are you insisting on being so difficult, Kane? Just relax your mind and let me see what Durga's up to.
Do your own chores, Snake Face.
There was a sudden flash in Enlil's eyes, and a massive tendril like the point of a sharpened log burst from the floor, rocketing toward Kane's heart. The Cerberus warrior lunged out of the path of the spearing limb. As the lethal point tried to slow itself and turn back toward Kane, he could see that Enlil's face was contorted with effort.
What's wrong, Enlil? Take too much energy to try to kill me?
The trunk of the tentacle flexed off to Kane's right, and he spun, hands rising. The log-thick point then rushed up, but Kane braced himself, grabbing the tip. The impact made his shoulders feel as if they'd pop out of their joints, but he knew that the battleground he was on was entirely in his mind. Though the lethal barb shoving against Kane was a product of a psychic assault, the death it would bring was very real. The physical pain he endured was an indication of the strain that Kane felt as he fought off Enlil's lethal effort. The point pushed, but the muscles in Kane's arms rippled. He could feel the sweat pouring down his face. Teeth gritted, Kane tried to shove the deadly spear tip away from his heart. If the shaft penetrated Kane's chest in this war of the wills, then his heart would be stopped. He could only imagine what was happening with his body in the real world.
No more witty comments, Kane. You'll tire, and once you weaken...
Another pair of hands appeared out of nowhere. Kane recognized their deep chocolate hue. To his right, Brigid threw her shoulder against the point.
Come on, Kane. Just breathe for me.
The trunk continued to push, but instead of Kane weakening, Enlil seemed to be fading.
Damn you, Kane.
The tendril disappeared, and Kane felt a pair of strong hands compressing his chest, someone else's lips on his.
I said breathe, Kane!
He's waking up!
Grant, get off my chest!
You stop breathing, asshole. We were giving you CPR.
Stop breathing. It looked like you were suffering a seizure at first, and then your breath stopped and your pulse faded. What happened?
Enlil. And it's confirmed. He has a means of psychic communication with Durga. But whatever it is, it's fairly limited.
It almost killed you. Fairly limited?
He was putting as much strength into killing me over our telepathic link as my body was putting into fighting it off. The moment you two pitched in to save my life, my psyche felt it, and the added strength helped me shrug it off. Enlil is curious about what we know about Durga. That's where his main limitation comes in.
He couldn't read your mind. So, he could be talking to Durga, but not aware that Durga has other ploys.
Correct. Which keys in to why Enlil didn't know about the consortium's presence until he heard me talking about it.
What did he hear?
When he initiated the psychic contact, I was asking if Bri had the coordinates of the consortium forces.
We were talking about our mistakes. You rubbed your eyes and then immediately collapsed in a seizure.
Immediately?
How long did his psychic attack seem to last?
Call it 2 minutes before you two assisted me.
You'd begun struggling, and after about the same amount of time, you stopped breathing. We took your pulse and began CPR.
And how long was Enlil's conversation with you?
3 or 4 minutes. So the telepathic interaction could only seem to an outside observer like it was only occurring in a moment.
Which is why you'd only heard a snippet of a whisper. You could sense the communication, but it moved at literally the speed of thought.
So, Balaam's mucking around, talking to me mind to mind, did leave me sensitive to nearby psychic phenomena. But Enlil's communicator worked like a speed dump. When I caught the conversation, I heard the whole thing, but it was put on extreme fast forward so I couldn't understand it.
Grant helped Kane to his feet. The ex-magistrate's legs felt rubbery, but his heart didn't seem to be under undue strain, despite the heart attack-like reaction his body suffered at Enlil's psychic assassination attempt.
What's to keep Enlil from trying to stop your heart again?
From the look on his face, he was feeling nearly the same shit he was putting me through. Another attempt might not work and could backfire on him. Enlil hates my guts, but not enough to burn up his body in the effort.
Sit down and let me get a listen to your heart. You were as close to dead as you can get. I want to make certain that nothing's weakened.
Good idea. I wouldn't want to suffer a coronary in the middle of kicking the consortium's ass. Oh, before I forget, did Bri find those assholes?
The satellite picked them up on infrared. We have the coordinates.
You two stay here, Kane. The rest of us will take this to the Queen. She's allowed me to have an audience with her whenever I want. What?
Shizuka is going to be jealous of your new girlfriend.
The Queen appreciates the man who personally saved her life. And you should thank me. I was going to do the chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth all by myself. Let's go.
Grant marshaled Lakesh and Domi out of the suite. Kane started to peel out of his shirt. What, Fargo?
Don't stop on my account, you two.
Kane was about to take action when Bridget stepped in.
Wow! Hey!
Leave him alone! Go on!
She grabbed Fargo by the back of his shirt and shoved him through the door. Kane sat down on a sofa, doffing his shirt. Bridget was going through her gear bag, pulling out a stethoscope. A smile crossed his lips.
You know, I make a lousy patient.
Just don't talk during the examination.
Right.
Bridget cupped his chin, then leaned in closer. She checked his pupils, then quickly pressed her lips to his.
That's for being jealous over me. Just don't get any ideas that we have to paw each other like we're in heat. We've got too much to do.
Miles to go before we sleep together.
Bridget smiled, winking at Kane's addition to the poetic phrase. She pressed the stethoscope to his heart. The Queen looked at Grant, then back at the map coordinates that Lakesh had marked.
I wish that we had the ability to print out the satellite imagery, but we've never seen the need for that kind of communication set up in the field.
That's perfectly fine. You've given us both the location and estimated troop counts in each case. Durga would have wanted more proof, but I have no cause for disbelief.
But Durga seems to have control over the military, doesn't he?
He has his own personal guard and expeditionary force, but the bulk of the Naga military is kept deliberately away from being under the control of any one official. I'll present this to our advisory council and we'll mobilize a preemptive strike against the forces massed on our frontier.
I wish that our Mantas had some firepower or transportation capability.
Fortunately, our Air Force has no such limitations. Though if they are aware of our air assault capability, we should engage in a more stealthy approach.
We'll pitch in with that.
It's been a little too quiet for my tastes.
Kane and Bridget were escorted through the Queen's chamber door by two of Yun's guardsmen.
Apologies for being late. Kane had a psychic incident with Enlil.
Is this true, Kane?
Apparently, Enlil is not aware of the presence of the consortium, but according to Fargo, the consortium did have the support of an Anunnaki overlord who provided them with a route through your territory that avoided detection by your military.
Yes, Lakesh and Grant informed me of this. However, if it were an Anunnaki overlord, he would have to have his own telepathic powers to plot a course through our defenses.
Enlil's Psi-Muti powers don't work that way, at least not in terms of mind reading.
Whatever device Enlil used to project his thoughts is primarily for communication. He tried to kill Kane, but the psionic feedback was strong enough to cause Enlil physical distress in the attempt. I have a theory that delving into the memories of a human requires similar mental effort.
Enlil's amplifier wouldn't be able to pick up more than surface thoughts, not deep-down knowledge, not without causing mental harm to whomever he scanned. It would not be a subtle effort, especially since these projections are at range.
Chances are Enlil isn't within 1,000 miles of the Naga city. As to caring about whether his mind probe victims were harmed by the attempt, I doubt it. He's only seeking to do this stealthily. In fact, Enlil appealed to my suspicions of your son. My apologies, Your Highness.
I would not delude myself that the heroes of Cerberus would not notice a few discrepancies in my son's behavior. I always hoped that he would prove to be the noblest of kings, living up to his father's image.
I take it he has not?
Far from it. This will be one of his backward ploys. Despite the rules separating government and the military, Durga is one of the few who has the knowledge to have delivered this menace to our doorstep. And once they make the first move, he'll be able to rally the Naga Nation into bloody conflict against the consortium.
And since the consortium has operations around the world, that means going all over the planet and fighting a whole lot of humans.
It has been his goal. He is a bitter man. He was a bitter boy as well.
Our condolences.
Thank you. I would, however, prefer to keep this betrayal secret. There's no telling who my son has contacts with inside the military.
Which is why I would like to launch our preemptive strike right now.
Domi, I know you'd love a shot at the consortium, but I need you and Lakesh here to deal with the insurgent operation Durga's planned.
Not only has he betrayed us to the humans, but he has also organized a cult of Enlil worshippers to revolt against us. If one attack fails to inspire martial law, the other will surely succeed. I have birthed a monster.
I'm good at taking out snakes. And Lakesh has given me the name of the military officer who's in charge of the crazies. Give me the go-ahead, and I'll do what I do.
If you could take the traitor alive, Domi, I would appreciate it.
He'll be able to answer questions.
I'll request that Lakesh stay here in my chambers. He will help me to explain the situation to General Chimera. When that is over, I'll call an emergency council meeting.
Good. That'll give the three of us time to put the consortium's forces off balance.
I pity the millennialists and their pawns. May Enki smile upon your efforts.
Kane and his allies left the Queen's chambers. It was time to go to war. The radio on Durga's desk distracted the Naga prince from the daily paperwork of running his part of the Naga royal government. Even as he schemed and plotted to overthrow the old regime, install himself as a god, reforge his race into a crusading force that would scour the globe of the Anunnaki's taint and subjugate humanity, the drudgery of everyday life still burdened him. Durga picked up the microphone.
Durga! Enlil? No telepathic conference?
Shut your fool mouth. The more we converse, the more likely that the Cerberus folk will hear us.
What's wrong, Enlil?
I tried to deal with the human, Kane. Let's just say that my telepathic potential enhancer is no longer operable. Are you aware of the consortium forces camped near the hangar entrances to your subterranean city?
What? The consortium here?
It looks as if they'll have a second crack at you. I conferred with my personal contacts within the organization, and they claim that they are receiving information from one of my kind. There is a 450-strong force armed with rockets, light artillery, and grenades ready to breach your lair.
Blood of my father! Can you assist? I have my own rebels poised to engage in activity tonight.
I suggest you call them off and concentrate your energies on dealing with the consortium. They are not known for their gentle touch when thwarted. As for any assistance I can provide, all I can do is inform. Even with the speed of my few remaining skimmers, I will not be able to engage them before they are due to strike at dawn. Besides, how would you be able to explain my intercession on behalf of the Naga?
The Fist of Enlil is to take over our city in your name. You are claiming your rightful place by dispelling the human rabble.
You have a contingency for everything. You've lived so long among the fallible that you are prepared for disaster at every turn. I wish that I was so accustomed to dealing with failure that I had such foresight.
Such is the burden of perfection, sire.
I must disconnect. We have anybody listening.
That last barb had bitten the Anunnaki overlord hard. Durga wished that he could get into instant communication with Hedin, but his self-imposed discipline of operational security meant that such blatant displays were forbidden. Even the encrypted radio communications between Enlil and Durga had to be kept at a minimum to foil eavesdroppers. He contemplated his options. There were too many things that could go wrong. Certainly the Cerberus warriors had the information with which to interfere with the consortium, but thanks to his taciturn conference with Hedin, if they had been spying on him, they wouldn't have known of the Fist of Enlil's exact plans. The two irons Durga had in the fire were now hot enough to strike, and yet they depended on the ability and the trustworthiness of the Cerberus envoys. All of the information that Durga had gathered on them told him that they would possibly be able to derail everything. Durga's intercom lit up. It was Matron Yun's line.
What is it, Mother?
I am summoning the advisory council for an emergency meeting. Our allies from Cerberus have warned us of an impending threat.
I'm on my way.
The situation was straining the tapestry Durga had woven, but there were a few points of slack that still allowed the Naga prince a shot at victory. The first was that the very presence of the human assault force would drive the Naga to want to strike back against the Millennial Consortium. The battle's outcome would be far different, but it would still provide the provocation for a global war of extermination against the Millennialists. The second was that even a failed assassination attempt would give the Cobra folk a reason to distrust other citizens who opposed efforts to secure the safety of their people. Enlil had mocked preparation for failure, but Durga's web of deceit was well strung so that even if some threads were torn, others would take up the slack. Durga went to meet with his mother and the emergency council. He pitied their feeble efforts to bring about a new golden age. Blood would be shed, and after this meeting, he was certain that the son of a dead god and a live queen could evolve into a blood-drenched, torn-eyed crusader. All that it would take would be the death of that queen. Brigid, Kane, and Grant stalked through the Kashmir forest toward the Millennial Consortium.
150-1 odds. I know we make it a habit to butt heads with gods on a daily basis, but unless you have a good plan, we're not going to do much.
Don't worry, Baptiste. I know I'm not a one-man army.
Brigid looked at Grant, but the big man shrugged.
Don't look at me.
Says the man who once literally tackled a death bird and won.
They don't have attack helicopters.
You know, Kane, my statement was an invitation to be informed of your brilliant stratagem that will make the odds equal.
There's no way to even things up against the consortium's force. We can go toe-to-toe with beings like McCann and Enlil because even if they have incredible power, they're solitary individuals for the most part. As such, we can outthink them by working outside their usual strategies and perceptions.
Kane took out a map and pointed out a discrepancy in troop strength at some of the consortium's positions.
Artillery units. 3 of them.
They'll be used to provide both cover for the initial charge and to literally tear open the hangar.
So their assault plan hinges on the power of those heavy guns. We take them out and they'll be thrown off their game.
Looks and tactical acumen. Kane, a lady like that doesn't come along every day. Ought to marry her.
Kane ignored Grant's crack, much to Bridget's obvious relief. He handed out Copperhead submachine guns with grenade launchers attached to their muzzles. He also gave his two partners a trio of rifle grenades that would snap into the end of the barrels.
The plan's simple. Fire your rounds at the ammunition stores at each of the artillery sites. Then we fade into the jungle. The stacks of shells and powder should be large enough for even you to hit from 300 yards, Baptiste.
That's the range of these things with the grenades, but with the density of the trees, I don't think we'll have the luxury of being that far back.
No, the closer you get, the more likely you are to be hit by your own shrapnel. And if the detonating ammunition doesn't get you, then responding patrols of consortium troops will. I'm giving you 3 shots, because there's a possibility that we could miss, and we could end up having to face down an overly aggressive response team.
Shoot, and don't stick around.
No heroics, Baptiste.
Why can't you just tell the lady to be careful?
I've got an image to maintain.
Well, Kane, it's an image the whole damn world can see through. I know you two keep telling yourselves that there's a time and a place for everything, but stop putting on a charade as if you don't care. Sexual tension is only interesting for so long. It's not only forcing us to ignore the elephant in the room, but it's also an insult to me and Shizuka and Domi and Lakesh that a working partnership and a healthy adult relationship can't be maintained by 2 people who have proved themselves equals for the past 5 years. That's how Enlil ended up in your head, nearly killing your dumbass, Kane. You were so distracted by Lakesh chewing you out, and all because of a flash of jealousy for Bridget.
Kane whirled in reaction to some threat, and Grant fell silent, recognizing his friend's point man's instinct.
Another skimmer. It's an unmistakable sound.
At least it wasn't a patrol stumbling upon my relationship guru lecture. Unless those ships have super hearing.
Enlil told me that he didn't have any personal assets within 1,000 miles of here. That proves a lie.
Not necessarily. It could be another of the surviving Anunnaki.
Either way, I'm going to have to thank him for the divine intervention.
Kane slid his multi-optic visor into place. Grant and Brigid followed suit. Whereas the standard Anunnaki skimmer was a gleaming, smooth-skinned ovoid, this particular craft looked more as if it had been thrown together with random patches of metal and fiberglass. On one large fiberglass panel facing the trio was the stylized symbol of a featureless man. The blank-faced figure held a cornucopia horn in one hand and a sword in the other. The Millennial Consortium obviously had managed to salvage an Anunnaki dropship. Unlike the cosmetically scarred craft that the insurgent Naga tried to steal from Durga, this one had actually suffered severe damage, but the technocrats of the consortium had the resources to return it to flying condition, albeit without the flawless metal hull typical of the original Anunnaki design. The multi-optic visors were working at their maximum telescopic magnification to examine the hovering ship, and the trio looked long and hard to determine if the skimmer's weapons had been salvaged as well. If not, there was no doubt that the consortium would have been able to improvise a new armament package for the salvaged ship. Its presence was obviously to provide air support for the ground army's rush against the Naga stronghold, just in case the children of Enki were able to mobilize a few of their deathbirds.
Think there are any other crafts in the area?
Can't take it down. We'll give away our position, and without the element of surprise, we can't cripple their artillery column. But now we know that the enemy has its own eyes in the sky. If the sensors on those things are akin to what we have on our deathbirds, the forward-looking infrared won't be able to see an adult human through a tree trunk. Even if a small part is poking out around the side, if you keep low and don't allow too much of your body to be exposed, you can be mistaken for native wildlife.
The scanners were good for the area around Cobaltville because of the flat desert. Here in the forest, you'd need a ground patrol and seismic sensors for reliable observation.
The skimmer does make things a little more difficult. While it wouldn't be able to stop us from hitting the artillery sites, the skimmer will be able to respond and could catch one of us out in the open.
Grant looked at his copperhead, then the trio of explosive shells he had for the stubby weapon.
I do have an idea.
And you know I hate it when you want the enemy to get target practice on you. Besides, you're forgiven for the relationship advice.
I like living too much to let a skimmer beat me up over a pang of guilt.
How will you make certain that the consortium ship will come after you?
Simple. The two of you coordinate your attacks. The skimmer will be put on alert. After a sufficient pause, I pop my target and linger just enough to draw its attention. Maybe two magazines from the copperhead will do the trick. Once he comes down on me, I plunk a rifle grenade into the skimmer.
You get bumped off. Who's going to be our guiding mentor in the realm of healthy adult relationships?
Well, that's the other bit of genius to my little ploy. You two shoot first, and then instead of retreating back to the Naga subterranean city, you come and back me up. I'll have my hands full dealing with the skimmer, in case you forgot.
And here you thought he was being noble.
Sensei Grant, your student in Grape Fu may just be about to graduate.
As it should be when you train at the feet of the master. Come on, those artillery sites aren't going to blow up themselves.
Princess Hana, accompanied by her faithful bodyguard, swiftly entered the Emergency Advisory Council chamber, where other members of the royal family and the elected citizens of the parliament had assembled. Hana always felt self-conscious about bringing Manticore along with her to parliamentary hearings, simply because average Naga citizens had been entrusted by their government with the right to self-defense. Hana had a small dagger and a flat little pistol tucked into her belt sash, but Manticore's intimidating size and strength created a fearsome impression whenever she encountered one of the citizens. The queen, with her royal cordon, was a genuine treasure to the society, a keeper of ancient knowledge that she spent her lifetime passing on to others. The intricacies of royal intrigues had made a personal army a necessity for someone of her stature. Hana warranted a protector simply because she was betrothed to the last full-blooded prince descended from the royal lineage. At the same time, she relished Manticore's company. There was no denying the affection the two Naga shared, but because of her position and the promise of her marriage to Durga, neither of them could act on it. As such, the development of their relationship was platonic. Manticore could be counted on for endless conversation. As well, except for a few uncomfortable moments when Hana was bathing in the lagoon, he did not proffer her any special treatment that she didn't feel she warranted. They could laugh with and at each other. He kept her from feeling completely alienated or an object of pity because she was a creature on a pedestal. It was a sense of connection that she cherished. She took her seat, Manticore sitting beside her. The bodyguard didn't tuck himself up against the conference table, leaving himself room to respond if danger arose. It was a chilling thought that Hana allowed herself, especially in the wake of prior assaults by the Fist of Enlil. The Emergency Advisory Council meeting would be a juicy target for the troublemakers. However, the sight of Durga coming through the doors with his personal guard relaxed her. Durga was a conniving bastard, she thought, but he was not suicidal. With Durga present at the meeting, she felt a little safer. She smiled to Manticore.
We are in the safest place in the whole of the city.
Medicor looked doubtful but held his tongue. Hanna slid her hand into his under the table, their fingers intertwining.
We have a chance.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Durga passed the pair. From his vantage point, he couldn't see their clasped hands, but there was a knowing smile on his lips. Hanna felt the tender moment evaporate. Manticore untangled his hand from Hanna's. He tensed, rising to his feet, hand falling to the grip of his pistol. The torso of one of the Queen's guardsmen, shorn off just before the ribs and trailing flames, smashed through the doors. The emergency council rose as one as the worshippers of Enlil followed the severed body into the meeting hall, their energy weapons spearing yellow tongues of blazing death. Domi gauged the approach she would take against Hedin. The Naga colonel had two soldiers standing beside him, guarding him in his office. Though Domi was willing to cause crippling pain and permanent injury to the traitorous colonel, someone who had condemned himself by his own actions in leaving the Cobra people vulnerable to the predatory consortium, the two soldiers could have been innocent, honest men simply doing their job. With a lunge, she popped open the access hatch in Hedin's office. Domi's swift form lunged through the opening, and she hooked both hands behind the bodyguard's neck. She folded her knees up to her chest, turning herself into a dead weight around the Cobra soldier's neck, toppling him off balance. The unconscious Naga flopped limply as Domi spun out from under his settling form. The other Cobra soldier reacted with lightning speed, lunging at her with his fangs extended savagely. Barely avoiding the blow, Domi jammed her elbow deep into the crook of the Naga's neck. Grant's lessons in martial arts versus anatomy apparently also applied to the snake-modified humanoids as the soldier froze with temporary pain. The momentary paralysis wouldn't last long, so Domi followed up the attack with a knee to the sternum, and his legs folded beneath him. Hedin's stunned protectors weren't going to be rising soon. Domi turned in time to see the Naga turncoat reach into his holster for his gun. The snake traitor's speed was as fast as his serpentine counterparts, the draw coming so fast that the feral woman couldn't get out of the way of the 9mm round that Hedin had launched. Fortunately, the shadow suit gave her enough ballistic protection that Domi would only suffer a fist-sized bruise covering her porcelain-white ribs. Though Domi wasn't much more than 100 pounds, giving up another 75 to Colonel Hedin, it was the size of the fight in her, not her size in the fight, that mattered. 100 pounds of muscle and sinew plowed into Hedin, sending them both toppling into a bookcase. Domi ignored the rain of books and Hedin's struggles. She fired off knotty fists into Hedin's sides. Her knees smashed against his inner thighs and groin. The Naga conspirator took advantage of his natural weapons and flung his mouth wide open, intending to drive his fangs into Domi's neck, but the Outlander girl whipped her forehead toward Hedin's lower jaw. A statue toppled from the top of the broken bookshelf. Coming off Hedin, the statue finally drove Domi off him by thumping into her chest. Staggered by the sculpture's fall, the two combatants swayed for a moment, eyeing each other for an opening.
That was you spying on Durga and me!
Yeah.
The feral woman's ruby-red eyes regarded the snake man with an almost glowing rage in the confines of the office. One of Hedin's fangs twitched and folded back up, but the other had been driven through his lip, snapped in two by the force of Domi's headbutt. He felt the sharp point of his broken fang poking out of his jaw.
Bitch!
Domi charged forward, her head and shoulder crashing into Hedin's stomach. The bookcase, not meant for this kind of abuse, finally collapsed. Splinters gouged his back, and the sandwiching force of the albino Outlander and the immovable shelf broke ribs. Hedin's golden eyes gleamed with fear of the savage little human who had manhandled his bodyguards and him as if they were garter snakes.
Hey, surrender!
Where did Durga want the Fist of Enlil to strike?
They act when Emergency Council meets Consortium. Guts on fire!
Domi keyed her contact.
Mo! The council!
Beloved! Oh, dear God!
Domi whirled, knowing that she was needed at Lakesh's side. Hedin reached out, holding her wrist.
Please! Medical!
The man she loved was under attack, and she didn't have time to waste dealing with the traitor who'd arranged to endanger him. Manticore exploded from his seat as the assassins entered the chamber, aiming his Pinidad pistol at the leader. But he was wearing smart metal armor. The first few, though wounded by grinding their way through royal guardsmen, were so well protected by their bullet-resistant second skins that they continued to battle on. The corridor stunk to high hell as bodies burned and shattered torsos exposed the stench of shredded internal organs. Others in the fighting group swarmed in behind the armored Naga, serpent men wielding conventional AK-47 assault rifles. Though the citizens and the guardians of the royals had handguns, the swarm of murderers was at least 20 strong, led by a formation of nearly invulnerable killers armed with body-roasting energy weapons. Manticore aimed as he spotted one of the Anunnaki-armed assassins raise his arm toward the Queen's position. The bodyguard wanted to hit the turncoat cobra in the head, but the killer's head was protected by an armored shoulder. The rounds distracted the killer, though, and Lakesh aimed carefully. Manticore grabbed the princess and threw her under a table. A rock smashed into Manticore's forearm, jarring the weapon from numbed fingers. Hanna pulled a small Walter PPK. Manticore was moving to retrieve his pistol when Hanna grabbed his wrist.
Where are you going?
Lost my gun. Stay down and don't shoot. That puny little popgun won't do anything.
A searing pain lashed across Manticore's legs, burning fire that numbed him all over. No! He reached up and found his hand clasped tightly in Hannah's.
Manticore! Marley, hold on!
With a lithe leap, she grabbed at Manticore's fallen Pinidad and rolled over.
My girl can take care of herself.
Marley, no! Don't pass out!
She clutched his hand tightly and Manticore hung on. As always, she was his anchor. Mohandas Lakesh Singh was not a hardened warrior, despite the dangers he'd faced in the war against the forces that struggled to pry humanity's destiny out of its own hands. When the corpse of the energy-blasted royal guardsman had burst through the meeting room's doors, Lakesh didn't have the instincts or reflexes to pull his sidearm from its spot in his holster. However, the recovery of his youth had restored his courage and strength of will, and he didn't give in to blind panic. The Fist of Enlil cultists, some of them bleeding where their smart metal armor had been pierced by gunfire from the guardsmen, continued to pour into the emergency council chamber.
Body through, Creator!
Another snake man swung his asp forearm blaster toward the Queen as a guardsman aimed his pistol. Ah! A rain of debris poured from the roof and Lakesh lurched toward Yun.
Matron, get down!
More conventionally armed insurgents made their way inside. He watched in horror as one of Yun's protectors threw himself into the line of fire. Other guardsmen turned over the Queen's table, tucking her down behind it. Lakesh aimed his pistol again. But suddenly he was surrounded by dozens of snake men and women, all of them armed. What had been an insurgent strike had devolved into a two-way gunfight as free citizens and bodyguards entered the fray. Lakesh's detonics was empty. He tore out the old clip and fumbled, looking for a new one. The only one of his shots that had made a difference was at a distracted murderer whom Lakesh had aimed at for all of 2 seconds. The rest of his return fire was wild, and Lakesh wasn't certain that his bullets hadn't inadvertently struck his Naga allies from behind as they scurried for cover. A royal guardsman hauled Lakesh to the floor.
Stay down!
Lakesh was about to thank the Naga protector. With the protection of the table, Lakesh crawled toward Yun. Even though the thick wood gave them some protection, it wouldn't last forever. He reached out for her hand.
Come with me. We need to get out of here.
Yun scooped up a handgun.
I shall never see the fall of my nation, for I will die in a final effort.
Let's hold off that final gesture by finding something harder to hide behind.
Yun's lips grew tight. Lakesh remembered all the times Cerberus had been assaulted, the helplessness he felt when he witnessed the deaths of people who were his friends. That impotence was written on the Queen's face, and as much as he could sympathize with her, her protection was a duty that he could not shirk. He lunged forward and tugged on her arm, pulling her toward a stone column. Needle-sharp fragments prickled Lakesh all along his left side, and only natural reflex had kept one splinter from gouging into his eye. Lakesh reached out again, half-blind, to continue to get Matron Yun to cover. Yun writhed under the hail of murderous lead. She slumped against the stone column he was trying to hide her behind. Numbed, Lakesh turned to look at the renegade. The pistol in Lakish's right hand rose and he scowled, aiming at the murderers. An asp blaster glowed with its pre-discharge energy. Lakish knew he was going to die. Suddenly, a blur of pink and black launched through the doorway. In the clarity that comes with heightened adrenaline from a near-death experience, Lakish's eyes locked on the hurtling form of Domi, leaping on the blaster-armed assassin. Her scalp had been torn, blood turning her short, spiky hair a flaming pink. Domi's face was twisted in a rictus of rage as she rode the armored Naga to the floor, holding onto a handle that was jammed into the back of his head. Lakish recognized the pommel of Domi's fighting knife. The feral woman left her blade lodged in the skull of the insurgent Cobra. The .45 pistol was in her other hand. Domi moved as if she were born with it as a part of her arm, holding it at arm's length at an opening in a Naga's Nephilim armor. The more conventionally armed insurgent tried to follow the lithe, savage woman as she whirled like a tornado in the midst of the killers. But Domi had already abandoned the air where his bullets went. She lunged in, pushing her handgun ahead of her like a fencer with a sword. Domi leaped and scissored her legs around the neck of another hooded insurgent. Lakish lowered his gun, and the Naga survivors of the terrible attack watched as Domi staggered to her feet, blood-red eyes looking around the meeting hall. The heaving of her lungs made her shoulders rise and fall. She looked as if she were carved from ivory and obsidian glass, thanks to the midnight black hue of her shadow suit. Blood had seeped down her forehead and cheeks, turning her hair and face a shade of crimson, only slightly less intense than the ruby fire burning in her eyes. Silence reigned in the council chamber as the shell-shocked survivors held their breath and tried to determine whether the wild thing standing before them was finished with her task of bloodshed. Domi was a force of nature that had just single-handedly exterminated an assassination squad.